And we're gonna make our little start, wanna? We are very, very fortunate today to have a guest speaker, Rabbi Dr. Belofsky from London. I want to also thank, and I'll thank him later, he didn't manage to get here just yet, but Rabbi Elton from the Gate Synagogue, I want to thank him as well. Welcome also, Josh. Rabbi Belofsky is a guest of the Great Synagogue in Sydney at the moment. He's been in Perth, spent some time in Perth and then in Sydney. He told me that this is his 24th and last shiur and lecture that he's giving in Australia. I thought I was very honored because 24 is a very significant number. There are 24 books of the Tanakh. So
I might have counted wrong.
Rabbi Belofsky is the rabbi of the Golden Screen Synagogue in London, the CEO of the University Jewish Chaplaincy in the UK, and vice chairman of the Rabbinical Council of the United Synagogues.
That's what they say every time
that's
I speak.
That's only part of the biography, apparently. And today he's going to give a very, very fascinating topic, the mystery of who wrote the Nishmat prayer. You got some handouts and the sources, and once again, we wish you lots of atzlacha, Rabbi Belofsky, and
thank
you. Enjoy your stay here.
Thank you. It's been
lots
great.
Lots of atzlacha back in London, and we're very fortunate to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi Gerari. Thank you very much for welcoming me. It's good to be here. I'm going to tackle an unusual side. I must say I'm very slightly surprised that Rabbi Gerari selected this topic, because it's a little controversial, but let's see what we do with it. He asked me at the beginning, is it okay to record the class? And I said, it's okay to record it, providing I can decide what to do with it at the end. So let's see. We'll make a decision at the end whether I require him to delete it. So, many of you will be familiar with the Nishmas prayer. It is said on Shabbos and Yom Tov morning, just before the Chazan takes over, and it's also said as part of the text on Seder night after the meal. The Nishmas prayer is very ancient, and it talks about how the breath of all life will praise God, and it talks about how every aspect of the person will praise God, and all the wonderful things we praise God for. It is a kind of poem of prayer. It's quite long, occupies about a page and a half in the Siddur. And it's regarded very well, it's beautiful, the Hebrew is easy and elegant. And it is, for those who get to shul early enough, at least reasonably familiar. Now, what is not clear is who wrote this prayer. We don't know who wrote all of the prayers. The standard parts of the liturgy, that means the text of the critical prayers, that's the brochos, the text of the Amidah for various occasions. These we know pretty much come from the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men in the Great Assembly, beginning the Second Temple period, where there was a need to create a more formalized prayer rather than what had been perhaps more extemporized before that. But there are other parts of the liturgy which are less central, and there is more, let's say, vagueness about where they came from. And this class is an exploration of what appears to be an outrageous and almost impossible idea, that Nishmas, in fact, comes from a very suspicious source indeed. Perhaps about 10 years ago, I'd never come across this idea. You know, I learnt in Gated Yeshiva for many years, and it's not the kind of thing they had on the curriculum, whether or not Nishmas was written by the Pope. It wasn't really on the agenda, but I discovered more and more sources that actually suggest that it has a suspicious origin. Let's explore. So these sources are quite obscure. They have been translated or at the very least summarized in English, and they don't always appear in very appealing, nice digital form because they're not available in nice, appealing digital form. They have to be kind of scraped together from obscure sources. So we begin with a book called Siddur Chassidei Ashkenaz. Now, the Siddur of the Pietists of Germany is not a Siddur in as much it is simply a text from which one will pray. These books of that period, of the medieval German period, were tracts about prayer, ideas about prayer, explanations of prayer, as well as the text itself. And we're going to see a couple of citations like this from books that are called Siddur or Machsa, but are not a Siddur or Machsa as we know it. So the Siddur Chassidei Ashkenaz is a work from the German Pietist period, from around the 13th century, and it's talking about the origins of various prayers in this section. Nishmas Kol Chai. So, Mireb Yehuda Bareb Yaakov, It is known from Reb Yehuda Bar Yaakov, I'm reading from source one, and you'll see in a minute there's going to be a translation, Shereb Shimon Kifri Isad Osoi, that someone called Shimon Kifri wrote it. Ad mi yid meloch mi ishveloch. So if you're familiar with the text, near the end it starts saying, who is like you, God? Who is equivalent to you, God? There's a sort of a poem which repeats this theme in various ways about, is there anything comparable to God? So according to this view, Shimon Kifri, we don't yet know who this person is, was the author of the text from Nishmas all the way through to the near the end. Here's another little excerpt, and it's a footnote from the same book. Bamas, if you're following in the Hebrew, it's the second little snippet. Bamasa Yoshen Defush Zulzbach. In an old Masa, the Zulzbach edition, whatever that might be, Nishmas, with respect to the prayer Nishmas, Motsosi Kishim ben Kipa or Kipa Yastai. I found the same idea, that someone called Shimon ben Kippa, or Kifri, maybe there's a slight variation on the name, Kippa, he wrote it. Yesh Omrim Shimon ben Shetach, and some say Shimon ben Shetach, who is a known member of the sages, who appears quite often in the Talmud. How do we know? Veremas boy, there's a hint. Shimon, the name Shimon appears, it's called an acrostic. Many of our famous poems are written as acrostics, and so we have psalms and which are alphabetic, but later poetry sometimes is written where the first letter of each of the verses, if put together, spells out the author's name. The most famous example is Lechododi, which starts Shomor v'zochor b'dibur echod, and the Shin begins to spell out the author's name, which is Shlomo, because it was written by someone called Shlomo Alkabetz, who was a member of the Ari circle in the Galil in Sfat in the 16th century. So this is a comment. He says, you know how you know someone called Shimon wrote this poem? You can spell out his name. Shoichein Ad, that's a Shin. Miyid Meloch Mem. Ad Heino. These are just phrases from the poem. Ayin. The Ilu Finu, if our mouths were had sufficient praise, Vov, Nishmas is a Nun. Anyone who knows anything about this prayer will immediately think this is suspicious, because these are not in order, these phrases. You don't have to be a great genius in a large body of text to pick out the letters Shin, Ayin, Shin, Mem, Ayin, Vov, and Nun. So it seems a little odd. They've just been picked randomly. They're not actually in order at all. But in the meantime, this text says it's written by someone called Shimon, because his name is encoded in the text. And maybe it's Shimon ben Shetach, who is a known person, or maybe it's this other mysterious person, Shimon ben Kippur or Kipri. That's source one. Source two, which is translated, is an equivalent source in a much later Siddur called Seder Avodas Yisrael, which cites the correct text of the Siddur, but also some explanation and background. This is really an academic work on the Siddur. Again, apologies that it is written in this rather difficult text, the fourth word, or you can follow it in English. Tzasi bepirush yoshon sovel the Siddur kisvei yad mishnas kuf samach zayin v'hu ke minag trois. So I found in an old commentary written round the edge of a manuscript of a Siddur from 1406. You know, just light reading. He was just flicking through this one day. Written according to the customs of Troyes, which is where Rashi came from. So this is already 300 years after Rashi died. Rashi died in 1105, so it's 300 years after Rashi died. And we are still in the pre-printing era. Right, Vazela Shona, this is what it said. Shemati Rebbe Yehuda ben Yaakov, and you can see it sounds very familiar. I heard from Rebbe Yehuda ben Yaakov. Shreb Shim ben Kippi said Nishmas ad Miyid Meloch. The Reb Shimon ben Kippa was the author of Nishmas until the phrase Miyid Meloch, who is comparable to you. Ad Kandel Shona, that is the end of the citation from the marginal notes to a manuscript from 1406. Pirush Achim at Sasi Vazela Loshin. In another commentary, I found the following. Shimon ben Kippa. the Shimon ben Kippur, but some say Shimon ben Shetach wrote Nishmas. And again, he cites the same thing, that there is a backwards acrostic spelling out the name Shimon. So this idea appears in more than one place. And by the way, in a little bit of text I missed out, which was the final line of source one, it claims that Ahava Rabbo, which is the blessing that is said before the Shema, was also written by this person. We missed that out. It's not so germane, but it's a vague interest. Source 3 is from the Masoretry. Now, the Masoretry is the most important text on liturgy of that period. It's written not by Rashi, but by the students and yeshivas of Rashi. It's written by his students, and it reflects the views of the world of Rashi, the kind of 12th century, then 13th century, kind of pietist world of Ashkenaz. And in the Masoretry, we find the following. At the end of the first line, if you're following, I'm afraid I got bored with writing a translation, so I just wrote a few words. But you can see here, for Rabbeinu Yaakov, Rabbi Meir Poisek. Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of Meir, ruled. Who is Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir? It's Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam is the grandson of Rashi, regarded in the period of the Balei Tosfos, the second generation from Rashi, who wrote extensive essays in the Talmud, to be the most significant and most authoritative. The Bechol Yud Ches Brachos Yochel Adam Lechadish Bein Devorim Shehein Hodol V'Tefilo. Throughout the Amidah, a person can put in their own prayers. If you come to the prayer for wealth, you can add in your own thing. The prayer for health, you can add in your own thing. You can add your own, you can personalize it. Bein Devorim Shehein Srochel Hoyol U'Me'ein Brachohu Mechadish. Provided it's something which is relevant to the bracha itself. So if you're going to ask for health, you should ask health in the health bracha, and so on. V'lo yehavi hefsek bracha klal, it's not considered an interposition, interruption. And in fact, it's permitted to extend them. You'll be familiar with the fact that at certain times of the year, particularly Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we add in quite a lot of liturgical poems to the text, and that's a controversy whether that's permitted, but you can see he rules those Ashkenazim, those Ashkenazim, Western Ashkenazim, they love all this liturgical poetry. And a lot of it developed in that period. It was written by the Ashkenaz pietists in the 12th and 13th century, 14th century. It's fine. How so? Mimois Shimon, that's all introductory. Shimon Kippur, Shiasad Seder Shel Yom Kippurim, Etein Tilok. This goes back right to the earliest period, including a well-known liturgical poetry for Yom Kippur, which was written by Shimon Kippur. So although it doesn't refer to Nishmas, the idea that Shimon Kippur is one of the authors of important early liturgical material is validated by Rabbeinu Tam, who is extremely authoritative. So these texts are cited without much commentary. It is considered a valid view that the man called Shimon Kippur, who we've not yet identified, is the author of Nishmas and various other liturgical works. However, not everyone is very keen on this, because although I told you a bit at the beginning, the sources we've seen have not yet identified who this person is. But all the sources know who they're talking about, but they're using a code name, and we'll see why in a minute. Already in the medieval period, the people are very upset about this idea. They're offended by it. They're upset by it. So in the sources that I've labelled two, rejection in early and later sources, we find the following. Another excerpt from the very same work, from the Masoretry, it's source 4. And what does source 4 say? V'yesh sha'omrim al oisa novel shimon peter chamor. So now it's starting to get interesting. There are those who say about this novel. Novel means a vulgar, disgusting person. There are some people who say about this disgusting person. What's his name? Shimon Peter Chamor. Now, I need to unpack this. Shimon is obviously his name. Peter Chamor is a derogatory term. Peter Chamor actually refers to there's a mitzvah to redeem the firstborn of a donkey. And Peter Chamor means the firstborn of a donkey. But to call someone a donkey in this type of literature, it means you're a lowlife, a vulgarian, a grobber, whatever you want to call it, a grob person. So why call the person Peter Chamor, not just Chamor? Because he has a name, another name other than Shimon, by which he is widely known to posterity. What is it? Peter. Peter Chamor is calling him Peter the Donkey. It's a play of words. It's a medieval joke. The Mass Obituary is not generally studied for its humour. Its content may be of value. But Shimon Peter Chamor is saying his man was called Shimon. He's known as Peter, and we think he's a donkey. But it's a very, it required, as you can see, the joke required some unpacking. Right? I mean, he's probably not going to make it onto one of these comedy stalls. It's not really going to work. She toss, who is this guy? She toss shall roimo. Now, just that, these sources probably were copied badly. And when you see a round bracket, you ignore the text. And when you say a square bracket, you read because it's an amended text. Who is this guy? He's the toys shall roimo, the error of Rome. This is the way that the liturgical rabbinic text will say, he is the bad guy of Rome, right? Who is Peter, the bad guy of Rome? He is the founder of Christianity. This is Peter, Saint Peter, the first pope, right? Yester shall attend Elos Tfilo. There are people who say that this guy, you can see, this text is not very favourably disposed towards this idea. That Peter the donkey, the founder of Christianity, he wrote these prayers. Peshat of Phyllis, Keshahaya Allah Selah, and other prayers when he was on the rock. Doesn't mean he's visited Gibraltar. Okay, we'll see which rock. Just hold on to it.
Does that mean
that he was Jewish? But the Chas V'Sholem, first of all, he was definitely Jewish. That's not even in question. Of course he was Jewish. That's not even in question. The Chas V'Sholem Shalote Ezos B'Yisrael. God forbid, nothing like this should ever happen amongst the Jewish people. This is totally unacceptable. Totally unacceptable. V'chol ha'oyme dova zeh, and anyone who says such a thing, k'sheyivne beis ha'mikdosh, when the temple is rebuilt, yovi chatos shemeno, will have to bring a nice fat offering to atone for his wickedness. We think the lady doth protest too much. Why does he feel a need to write like this? Such vehement terms. There are terrible people who are saying this, that this awful, vile man, Peter, the founder of Christianity, wrote, God forbid you should say such a thing, and people who say such a thing, look, they're going to burn in hell. Well, he's got quite worked up about it. It must be quite a credible view. That's always the principle in rabbinic texts. When someone says something like this, there are people of authority, influence, who are saying it. If no one's saying it, you don't need to give it oxygen. He's refuting a well-known, or let's say, widely cited position. Right. Now, that I would describe, that's from the world of Rashi, if not Rashi himself, a vigorous rejection that God forbid this man. But you see it now, Shimon Kippur is St. Peter. That text has identified him, and we know who it is now. And he was on the rock, we'll see what that means. Just as a side, the one of the most famous European Masorim, Josh will certainly have heard, is Rödelheim. So the Rödelheim Masor was from the German tradition, was regarded as one of the greatest ever printings of the Masor, and it was edited by someone called Wolf Heidenheim. So it's not Heidenheim from Rödelheim, it's probably, I wouldn't say it too many times, a bit of a tongue twister, but Wolf Heidenheim from Rödelheim makes an observation about the development of Purim. Now, I obviously saw a reference to this. I wasn't flicking through Heidenheim's introduction to Hishmini Atzeres Machzor. This is probably not very well read, if anyone's in fact ever read it. But someone dug this out. And he says as following about liturgical poems. Ela Paitanim v'Ela Piyuteim. These are the poets, and these are their poems. Ashen siastu bisidureinu marasholonu, that they were established as part of our sidur. He's justifying, certainly in the German tradition, there's a real interest in putting a lot of liturgical poetry in. And some people say it's too long, some people say it's boring, some people say it constitutes an interruption in the davening. But he's saying they are holy, they are very great, of great ancestry and great authority, and they are a part of the tradition that's been passed down to us. They were all scholars some from the land of Israel, some from Babylon, some from Spain, some from France, some from Germany. But they were all written within a period of 300 years. They're written in about a 300-year period, between about 1100 and 1400, and none of their very ancient prayers are written with acrostics. That's all we need to see. Heidenheim is the expert in this. Do you remember that the other sources said, you know how someone called Shimon wrote the book, wrote those prayers, because there's a Shimon, there's an acrostic in the text? He said, no, that was invented in the medieval period. That's not correct. So the proof that it's written by someone Shimon is probably incorrect, because the idea of encoding your name in the text is a product of maybe of the 13th century, and this text was written in the 2nd century, written 1,000 years earlier. In the meantime, you can see that there are scholars who are advocating quite comfortably that the author of Nishmas and some other prayers is Shimon Kippur, whom we've just identified as Peter, and others who vigorously reject the idea. Let's move on. The Sefer Chassidim, which is also from the same period, written by Yehuda HaChassid, also one of the pietists of the Ashkenaz period, from the stable of Rashi, he provides us with quite a lot of the customs and practices, hanhogas, I would say, kind of ways of practice that characterize Ashkenazi Jewish life. And in section Kuf Tzadi Aleph 191, he discusses it's a bad thing to call someone by a derogatory nickname, unless they're a bad person. Yehudi Shehimir, a Jew who becomes an apostate, converts to another religion. Mechanin loy shein, it is permissible to use a derogatory name, even though the rabbis say that if you use a hateful or derogatory name for someone, you lose your portion in the afterlife. It's very bad news. That doesn't apply to someone who is an apostate. It's important to understand the context in the medieval period, in the Crusader period. These are real issues. These are real issues. Shnemaz, the verse says, Kamoyem yuyoseihem. It's a verse you might know from Hallel. Those who make them should be just like them, meaning...
He was a Jew and got out of Judaism, or the other way around?
No, he's a very famous rabbi. He's writing about that it's permitted to call a heretic by a derogatory nickname. He's the author, Yehuda Chosid is a famous rabbi from the period, and he says, but even though generally we don't call people by nicknames that are they don't like or derogatory, there's a verse which says, those who worship idols should be just like them. You can call idols by bad names. You can call the idolaters by bad names too. You can call people by a bad name. He gives some examples. If the person's name was Avraham and he becomes a heretic, you can call him Afram, which means like dirty person, dust, nobody. Okay? And similar, this is just an example. Va'afil latzadik, v'heim tom achrov. And even if the person was righteous, but people err after him. This is very peculiar. We've just said we're talking about evil people who convert to other religions. And now he says, but it also applies to someone who is a tzadik, a righteous person, but people make the mistake of following them. What does that mean? And who is it referring to? So he gives an example. Guess who the example is? Kamoi Shimon Kippur. Our guy Shimon, he's an example. And what's the example of the derogatory name by which he is commonly known? Sha'omrim Petach Hamor. He's known as Peter the Donkey. And that's acceptable. We don't really know what Yehuda Chosid means. What does it mean that he was a tzaddik and people erred after him? We're nearly there. We only have two more sources, but the last is quite long, but you'll be pleased to hear it's entirely in English. Now, here's a bit about censorship. There are passages in the Talmud which are uncomplimentary about Christians, which make observations about things that happened of historic interest in the Roman period, particularly around the advent of Christianity, particularly around the circumstances of the death of Jesus, and so on. Those passages appear in early manuscripts of the Talmud, but for most of the period of printing, printing presses were controlled by Christians. And Christians were in a position to authorize or forbid printing of Jewish texts. And that means that particularly the tractate Avodah Zorah, which is deals with idolatry, rules about idolaters, observations about idolatry, and in the tractate of Sanhedrin, when there are other references, there are passages that we know to have been censored. And if you want to find the original, you have to go back to texts like Duke Sofrim and others, which have trawled through four of the original manuscripts and recovered the original. That's why manuscripts are very important. These days, with the proliferation of digital text, it's relatively easy to do this. But prior to this, you had to go to a library that had a pre-censored text, if you could find one. Censorship doesn't work anymore because people can always find the censored text online. But prior to this, if you took a piece out of a book and then printed it without it, after a while, no one would ever see this text. And there are some very crude censorships. In the Midrash on Eicha, the Book of Lamentations, the original print just had spaces in it. They just took the space that you can't print that bit because it says things we don't like. You can cut it out. And there are also usages throughout the Talmud. The use of the word akum, which means ode kachovim or mazolos, people who worship stars and constellations, probably was put in by Christians who regard themselves not as idolaters. So it refers to other, whereas the original text probably referred to everyone, including them. There are many, many such examples. There is a famous piece in the Gemara in Gittin which talks about, posthumous upcoming Jesus may have received. What was his punishment? And it's extremely uncomplimentary. And you will imagine that as a result, the text that we have is doctored. I mean, you have to know when to look back at the original. Okay. Now, the Tractate of Avodah Zorah, which deals with idolatry and idolaters, is the one that has been subject to the most censorship. Fortunately, there are manuscripts, and there is a recovered piece from a Rashi on page 10a of the Tractate of Avodah Zorah, which casts some light on what we've just seen in the Sefer Chassidim and will enable us to tie all the ends together that we've been seeing. Because while we saw in the original sources a disagreement about whether it could possibly be true that this man, Shimon Kippur, was the author of Nishmas, there's obviously a backstory which we're trying to recover. What's the story behind all of this? So, this Rashi is fragmented, and as often with recovered texts, it's incomplete, but we will be able to extract something from it. So, we don't have the original Gemara. It's not necessary to look at the original Gemara. And he's talking about the texts written by, and this text, does not appear. If you open a Gemara of Avodah Zorah and you look at the Rashi, it's not there because it's been cut out, and this is from the recovered text from the manuscript. So it makes the following observation about the texts of this new group. The Gemara is writing in the early Christian period, and the texts are quite new. They are called the Gospels. What did Rashi, on his commentary to Avodah Zorah, have to say about the Gospels and their authors? As you will imagine, it's not terribly complimentary, which is why it was taken out by the censors. Look at the bracket from the second line. Kol Sifri Ta'usom. All the books of their errors, which means that they're basically nonsense books. It's a bad start if you're a Christian reader. He's in the books. Yochanan Paulus Petrus. Right? Who are these people? Yochanan is John, Paulus is Paul, Petrus is Peter, right? I don't mind to Luke and Matthew, but maybe they'll appear some other place. Vehem Yehudim Hoyu. The first is they were Jews. You know, they're all Jews. All the early Christians were Jews. In fact, this is off track. If you know anything about the history of early Christianity, until a man called Shaul, who changed his name to Paul, decided on the road to Damascus that they were, it was no longer necessary to observe Jewish law, and they would begin to sell this new religion to non-Jews as well as Jews. It was a Jewish movement, a movement populated by observant Jews who believed that the Messiah had come. Obviously, over a period of time, it moved away and it became deliberately anti-Jewish, which is the source of anti-Jewish Christian sentiment. In fact, there was even the Church of James. James is the brother of Jesus, who stuck to this original plan, but eventually they disappeared. So all of the apostles were Jews, but we tend to view them as heretics, people who were responsible for another alien religion, who have bequeathed to history a terrible problem. That's how we normally view it. They were Jews. And then it gets, again, it's very fragmented and it's hard to read. I'll read it through. A grammatical, who alashon shemadabrim by agolochim, then there's a reference to a language, and it says grammatica is obviously the same Greek word that gives us the word grammar, and it means it was a sort of religious language that was used by priests. Heim shonu v'onkoloshin, they deepened and developed this language. V'osu lehem hevel lechashvom bifnei atzmon l'salkum me'al Yisrael. So what did they do? These people, and this is the bit where it's clearly, the text is clearly incomplete. These people, who have they mentioned? John, Paul, and Peter. They entered the group we call Christians in order to guide them away from the Jewish people. They did not become heretics, because their intention was for the benefit of the Jewish people. But Mitarmisi Yeshu, but because they saw the Jewish people were in distress and under pressure, because all the machinations of Jesus and his followers, they behaved as though they were one of them, they were part of their religious grouping. And they gave instructions about various things, as explicit in a book called The Hanging of Yeshu. One would probably imagine also not terribly popular with Christian censors. The book called The Hanging of Jesus. This is an original Rashi manuscript, or at least what we have of it. And it's saying something extraordinary. It's saying, first of all, it is not news to anyone who knows anything about that period. These guys were Jews, all the original Christians, all the apostles, all the people involved were Jews. We don't think of them very favourably because they created a religion that historically has been antagonistic to Judaism. But what was the goal? To somehow deal with the problem, and they were undercover agents. That's what it means. They were agents with a particular mission, but they were undercover. Where is all this coming from? So fortunately, there have been a lot of research into manuscripts of Midrashim, and they're in Eisenstein's collection of Midrashim. Eisenstein was an anthologizer who collected fragments and bits and pieces of Midrashim from all over, then brought them together in a kind of compendium for general use. He has a Midrash called Midrash Shimon Kippur, a Midrash, a kind of rabbinic legend or story dealing with Shimon Kippur, dealing with this fellow. Unfortunately, someone has chosen to post a translation on the internet, which we have here. And this Midrash, perhaps I'll offer some comments about what I think of the Midrash at the end, but this Midrash, or various versions of it, because there are other versions, is clearly the origin of the whole conversation. This is where it starts. After the passage of time, the quarrel between the Jews and Christians, and you can see that this is about the middle of the first century of the Common Era, because it's before the destruction of the temple, as is evident from the text. The temple is destroyed about the year 70. It's before that. It's also after the death of Jesus, which is about the year 30. So it's between 30 and 70, so very roughly 50. That's when this is. You will see. They're Christians from our perspective. This Midrash is obviously written much later, reflecting on that period, and that's why we have to be very cautious. We should not treat this as a historical account. This is not someone standing at the Battle of Waterloo making notes. Right? The quarrel between the Jews and the Christians grew to the point that when a Christian encountered a Jew, the Christian would kill the Jew. I'm not saying this is true or not. This is Midrashim or inspirational texts. They are polemical texts. But there is always a nugget of truth, even if the polemic is overdone. Just run with it. The problem grew and grew for a period of 30 years. The Christians gathered by the thousands, so it's probably around the year 60 then, because Jesus died in about the year 30. The Christians gathered by the thousands and tens of thousands and interfered with the ability of the Jews to travel to Jerusalem for the holidays, causing the kind of difficulties for the Jews that the Jews had not encountered since the sin of the golden calf. The Jews were at their wits' end and did not know what to do. In the meantime, the number of adherents to the beliefs of Christians were growing. 12 of their representatives travelled to 12 different nations. Who are these? These are the apostles to 12 different nations and spread their prophecies and influence Jews to join them. It's a movement to the Jews. It's a mission to the Jews at this stage in its history. They were men of renown who strengthened the belief in Jesus because they said that they were his representatives. By such, we're now on the last page of your handout. Penultimate page. By such means they transformed many Jewish people into adherents. Our sages witnessed this evil, and it disturbed them greatly. One said to the other, "Woe to us, for we must have sinned, that in our time such an evil that was unheard of in our day and in our ancestors' times could arise among the Jews." It distressed them greatly. They wept and turned their eyes to heaven and cried out, "Please, Lord, O God of the heavens, provide us with a suggestion as to what we should do, because we are at our wits' end. Our eyes are pointed towards you because innocent Jewish blood is being spilled, all because of that man." And that also, that phrase, "that man," traditionally we didn't use his name, but the texts do. He was called Osar Ish, that guy. "Until when will this be a danger for us? You are strengthening the hold of the Christians over us. They are killing us one by one, and our number is dwindling. We recognize this is occurring due to our sin. You, out of respect for your name, share with us some advice that we may be separated from the Christian community." After completing their plea to God, one older man from among the elders arose, and his name was Shimon Kippur. Finally, we get some story of who this guy is. "He summoned a voice from heaven and said, 'Listen to me, my brothers and my people. If it is acceptable to you, I will take measures to separate the Christian community from within the Jewish people.'" So you can see where the idea in Rashi is coming from. It's drawn from this Midrashic tradition. "They will then no longer have any part or interest within the Jewish people." So the solution is to try to make Christianity as dissimilar from Judaism as possible. Put a clear blue water between the two. "I will do this only if you will agree to accept the responsibility for the sins that I'm about to commit." All those present answered as one, "We accept that responsibility." "Just do as you suggested." Shimon Kippur went into the Bet HaMikdash, the temple, and recorded God's ineffable name. He ripped open his skin. I'm not commenting on any of this. He uses some Kabbalistic, some mystical method, and placed the name of God in there. He left the Bet HaMikdash, the temple, and took out what he had written and memorized God's ineffable name. He traveled to a central city of the Christians and cried out in a loud voice and said, "All those who believe in Jesus should come to me because I am a messenger of Jesus." They said to him, "Show us a sign." He asked them, "What sign would you like to see?" They responded, "Perform the same acts that Jesus performed to us in his lifetime." Shimon Kippur said, "Bring me a leper." And you'll know there's a story in the Christian Bible about Jesus healing a leper. They brought him a leper. Shimon placed his hands upon the leper and the leper was healed. Shimon then asked them to bring him a corpse. They brought him a corpse. He placed his hand on the corpse and the person came back to life. The people witnessed these acts and prostrated themselves on the ground and said, "Indeed, you are the messenger of Jesus, because he performed the same acts for us during his lifetime." Shimon Kippur said to them, "I am the messenger of Jesus, and he commanded me to come to you. Promise me that you will perform all that I command you." Together they answered, "All that you command us, we will do." Shimon Kippur said to them, "Know that Jesus hated the Jews and their Torah. His feelings were dictated what Yeshua," that's Isaiah, "said, 'I despise,'" the first chapter of Isaiah, "'I despise your calendar and your holidays.'" No further, that is taken out of context, of course. "No further that God no longer favours the Jews as Hosea prophesied, because you are no longer my nation," first chapter of Hosea. "Although God has the power to instantly oust the Jews from the world, God does not wish to destroy them." And this is what is called replacement theology by Christians. God wants them to remain, so their suffering will be a reminder of the future generations. Remember this? The wandering Jew, that God, as it were, makes the Jew wander, causes the Jew to suffer, as for his sin of not accepting Jesus. So this Midrash is familiar with this idea and attributes it to this episode. No further, that the great suffering that Jesus endured was to rescue all from hell. Now Jesus admonishes and commands you not to inflict any more punishment on the Jews. If a Jew asks a Christian to walk with him a mile, you should walk with him for 2 miles. If a Jew smites you on the left cheek, allow him to smite you on the right as well. So the Jews will receive their reward in this world and will be punished in hell in the next world. This is buying into a number of Christian tropes, turn the other cheek and various things. The author of the Midrash was clearly also familiar, not just with Jewish traditions, but also with aspects of the Christian Bible. If you follow in that path, you will merit living near Jesus. He further orders you not to celebrate Passover, but rather celebrate the day of his death, Easter. Instead of saying Shavuos, celebrate the 40 days from when he was stoned to when he rose to heaven, Lent, in place of celebrating Sukkot, celebrate his birthday, Christmas, and on the 8th day after his birth, celebrate the day of his circumcision, New Year's Day. All responded and said, all that you have suggested we will do, but only if you remain with us. Shimon answered, I will remain with you, but only if you allow me to do as I was commanded, which was not to eat anything other than simple bread and water. Why is this? Because he doesn't eat their food. In addition, I ask that you build a tower within the city where I will live until the day of my death. They answered, as you request, you will do. So he effectively becomes a monk. They built a tower, and the tower became Shimon's home. By the way, what is this tower? St. Peter's Basilica. They further fulfilled his request that they bring him only bread and water. He continuously resided within the tower. There he continued to serve the God of his forefathers. So he basically remained an undercover observant Jew, according to this Midrash, Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. And what did he do with his time? He composed many liturgical poems and sent them to the four corners of the Jewish world so that the poems will be a reminder in each generation of what had occurred. All the poems he composed he sent to his teachers. Shimon resided within the tower for 6 years and then he died. He ordered that upon his death he be buried in the tower, and they complied with his wishes. Later they built upon it a great edifice. That edifice is still found in Rome and they called it Peter Rock. Do you remember the rock? What does the word Peter mean? Petrus in Greek means rock. Pierre in French. That's where the word comes from. His name really means the rock. Peter, who lived on the rock, in a rock, on a rock, who sent out liturgical poems to the Jewish people. Does this start to sound familiar? This is where the legend or the idea comes from. That is the name of a rock upon which his home rested until the day of his death. And after the dots, a slightly variant version, Shimon Kippur remained in the tower by himself, takes the story back a little bit, and composed many edicts. And the non-Jews accepted them. At the same time, so he spends his time as a double agent. He's sending instructions to the Christians to guide what their practice further, to leave the Jews alone, and to guide their religious practice further and further away from Judaism, so people won't confuse the two. At the same time, he composed many liturgical poems for the Jewish people. This is a different version of the end of the text we just saw, and all of them are known by his name. So the tradition that we are hearing from the 13th century that these texts were written by him comes from a much earlier Midrash, which we've just read. He wrote to the Jewish people, no house of Israel who believes in God and in his perfect Torah, that it is a true Torah and the Jewish people represent God's nation. I, Shimon Kippur, who suffers all of these difficulties out of love for God, know the differences between truths and untruths. Please accept my liturgical poems that I have composed so that God will forgive me and you. All that I have done for your tranquility and your safety. That is why the Reb Yehuda Chosid, on a couple of pages ago, uses this as an example. Are you allowed to call a man who was righteous, but people followed him erroneously? Are you allowed to call him by a bad name? In the context of our understanding of Christianity, you are. But why is he a tzaddik? Because of his motivation. Why he's righteous? It's a very strange story. Accept my compositions with joy and send them to the head of the diaspora, and show my liturgical poems to the heads of the yeshivot and to the Sanhedrin. All remarked how well written and pleasant were the poems. It is appropriate that prayer leaders recite them during prayer services, even until today. This Midrash was surely not written later, any earlier than the medieval period. It is customary to recite the poems during prayer service on each and every Shabbat. This Shimon Kippur is also the one known as St. Peter. It's an absolutely extraordinary text, but it explains everything. It ties all the ends together. It's the most extraordinary text. Is it true? Who knows whether it's true? Whether it's a story that is invented to explain something? My sense about these midrashim is that they contain a kernel of truth. The story is clearly amplified. That doesn't matter. What matters is whether the core idea is true, and there isn't any reason to assume that it isn't. Because it explains how this idea is filtered into Jewish folklore, how it's filtered into text, how when in the medieval period people start to write Sidurim, Machzorim, which discuss where the prayers came from, their authority, their authorship. These are known ideas which you either accept, or in the case of the Machzavitch, we saw at the bottom of the first page, fight with, because you don't like it. We will never know whether the story is true. But what we do know now is where the tradition comes from, and have a completely different perspective on the founders of Christianity seen through the lens of this Midrash, and the possibility, at least possibility, that the founder of Christianity, because although Jesus, of course, is the inspiration, the founder of Christianity is Peter, it's not Jesus, is in fact also the author of some of our best loved prayers. Just to finish, there's one very short source here. In the Laws of Fasts, talks about the public fast days. There are various public fast days in the year. And it mentions one that we've never heard of. The 9th of Teves. The 10th of Teves we know. The 10th of Teves appears, it comes in December or January, and it is one of the fasts that commemorate the destruction of the temple, the siege of Jerusalem. We've never heard of a fast on the day before, the 9th of Teves. So in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, the Tor, in fact the predecessor, it writes, Bates boy, lo kosu rabbisenu al mahu. On the 9th of Teves, the rabbis wrote it as a fast. It didn't catch on, clearly. But they wrote it as a fast. They didn't say what it was for. They never wrote what it was for. There are sources that say they didn't really want to say what it was for because the purpose of the fast of the 9th of Teves was to mark the yahrzeit of St. Peter because of his contribution, but it had to kind of be kept a bit off the radar. It clearly never caught on. I've never met or heard of anyone. Have you heard of anyone who fasts on the 9th of Teves? No, I've also never come across anyone. But there are sources that suggest that the reason why would they conceal the reason? Because it was difficult to explain that this man had such a huge impact, that it was a sort of undercover fast that was observed maybe by certain scholars who appreciated the contribution of what is a very, very controversial figure. So, some interesting ideas, something completely different. I would guess that unless you come across this idea, I've certainly never heard a shiur like this. So, apart from the 15 times that I've given it before. But it gets better every time, and it's like cholent. It's the cholent that depends on the guests. And so the quality of the shiur is somewhat dependent on the quality of the audience, and so I think this has been a good one. So thank you, and I am finished. You can ask a question. We've got time. But no one seems to be very interested in the alternative. It's also not very interesting, the alternative. It's like, okay, so a great rabbi wrote it. That's not a very interesting story. An interesting story is a controversial person wrote it. So no one's interested. If it's because Shimon Zalzani, it was Shimon Shinsatov writes it. Yeah, who he was. Yeah. But there's no suggestion he's involved in it. Because he writes very complex. He writes a completely different type of poetry. Yeah.
Christianity became a pope,
like
Jews have to excel at whatever they do.
Yeah.
But
he's the best pope.
So, yeah, that's right. So, once that all happened, doesn't matter how beautiful whatever he wrote, why didn't they just get rid of it?
Because it would appear to be of value. It's almost as though it's a testimony to what he did, which appears to have been saved Judaism. According to this reading, again, whether it's true or not, according to this understanding, this guy saves Judaism. He saves Judaism by sacrificing himself and steering it so far, Christianity so far away from Judaism, that they could no longer be confused. The problem. Yes, yes, it's interesting. But he also calls him a tzaddik. So he knows the Sefer Chassidim, the Shimon Kippur, is the Jewish name for St. Peter. And yet he says he's a tzaddik.
So he did this for the purpose of separating.
This is what the
today's Jews for Jesus. They want to bring it together.
So what he's doing is he's steering the Christians away from Judaism. Rather than it was Jews for Jesus, say Jews towards Christianity. It's totally the opposite. And he remains a figure, a controversial figure, according to this reading, which is that on the one hand, this is not the kind of behaviour we expect from people. On the other hand, there may be a clear understanding. And why do we retain his poems? Because it's testimony, it's a memory to history that what he did, which according to this understanding, was to save Judaism. And how did he sort of, as he preserve his own memory? Don't forget about me. I'm the guy who sacrificed himself and I'm now trapped in the tower. They've made me the Pope. What shall I do? Well, what he does is he sends his time writing Nishmas and various other things. And we are still here in Australia in the 21st century remembering him for this, if you know the text. It kind of worked. So thank you very much. We're done.
Thank you very much.